Welcome to the University of East Anglia Pioneer Podcast, where we find out how UEA is tackling the world's greatest challenges and transforming lives with help from our generous philanthropists through the Difference Campaign. This is episode 3 of a short series about the unique work on prostate cancer, which is happening at the Bob Champion Research and Education Building. We now know how Professor Cooper and his team found a way to revolutionise prostate cancer diagnosis, and how the two tests they've developed could help prevent unnecessary surgery and even save lives. During this third and final episode, we'll find out how these tests could find their way into clinics in the UK and around the world. And we'll hear why this was the last thing Professor Cooper ever imagined he'd be doing.
No intention of ever being in this place ever in my life, and it's kind of slightly strange, but it's working very well.
And we'll find out what living without a prostate involves.
Your erection is about an inch smaller than it used to be because they've cut an inch of your urethra and all the rest of it out. And sexual intercourse with my wife, it's something that needs to be chemically enhanced, shall we say.
Plus, we'll hear from the man who has the best job in the world.
It's hard to put it into words, really. It's rewarding. You sort of get up on a Monday and think, yeah, there's nothing about it I dislike.
But first, let's hear more from Professor Colin Cooper, who heads up the research at UEA, about why this next step is the scariest thing he's ever done and why he's doing it.
We never intended to set up a diagnostic laboratory. We always imagined having a commercial partner. But when we started to look into this, it became clear that setting up such a laboratory was really the only way that we could ensure that we would meet our end goals of producing a test that could be used as widely as possible and be cheap. So we got into the complexities of setting up our laboratory, fundraising ourselves for all the equipment, for the personnel. But I don't know how to set up a diagnostic laboratory on my own. So we're very fortunate that we have a committee of people who are experts in doing this. But a critical part of that is we have to do our own fundraising. And they're always asking me, you know, can we do this next bit? Can we do the next bit? And I'm saying, well, okay, we've got the money to do this, and we just need to do a bit more fundraising, and we've got the money to do the next thing we want to do.
Sounds like a real adventure and somewhere you could not have predicted.
No intention of ever being in this place ever in my life. And it's kind of slightly strange, but it's working very well. And there's a lot of momentum, and there's so many people supporting this that I feel really humbled by the whole process.
And there's still a lot of support needed, with the team now on the final push to reach their fundraising goal of £3 million. We'll find out how it'll be spent a little later in the episode. But for now, let's catch up with Trevor Beckford, who's been telling us how he navigated his way through the current process of diagnosis for prostate cancer here in the UK. When we left him last, he'd just had a PSA test suggesting something might be wrong with his prostate. And so he went for a biopsy.
The biopsy came back with a trace of cancer. So I had a very small amount of cancer there, and it was not aggressive. Okay. So I went along to, obviously, for the consultancy follow up, and they said, oh, you need to have treatment straight away. And I went, whoa, hold on. I've done a bit of reading around this. I'd hit the internet a little bit, and I knew that prostate cancer is one of the most overtreated cancers there are. The impression I got is that the medical authorities treated it as a treatment without a downside or without any significant downsides. Whereas, of course, it does have significant or potentially significant downsides.
He and his doctor agreed he should go on what's called active surveillance, keeping an eye on it.
So that was it. And he said, oh, well, shall we, you know, have this conversation again in a year's time? So I said, hang on a bit, let's make it 6 months' time, shall we? Because you don't know, do you? Actually, because of hospitals and all the rest of it, I don't think I got my second biopsy until nearly a year as it was. But perhaps that was, in, as it turns out in hindsight, to be a good thing. Because if I'd said a year and it had actually taken 18 months, that might have been too late. Because the second biopsy showed that although I was only getting, I still think it was only one sample that came up with cancerous tissue, it was the whole of the sample was cancerous and it was aggressive. And the MRI revealed that it was right on the edge of the prostate, and there was fears that it either could have or had already burst out of the prostate and was therefore, you got cancerous cells circulating in the body.
The diagnosis was one thing, but what Trevor found most difficult was having to make a choice about whether to have surgery or not.
I was seeing the consultant and he was saying, right, you've got two choices. And I now know, I didn't know then, that some people don't get two choices. Some people get just the operation, you know, cut it out, surgery type thing. And some people just have a radiation therapy type thing. And, you know, I was saying to him, well, I've got the two choices. How do I choose between them? You know, what is best? What is going to give me the maximise the chances of me dealing with it? And he wouldn't say. He said, well, they're about the same. And you think, that's not the answer. You know that, and I know that, because they're two different, entirely different approaches. And whereas the, you know, ultimate success rate might be the same, and I'm not doubting that, you know, there are, you know, there's different side effects, all of that stuff, and you're not really helping me. You know, you've gone through the tick box, so I know that there are side effects. I know, you know, that there may be, you know, erectile dysfunction. I know that there may be this and that and the other. But you're not helping me here. You're not really. I don't want you to make the decision. I just want you to advise. And this is, I found this particularly frustrating because I'm used to giving advice as a lawyer.
Dr. Kate Manley says the PER test and the TIGER test could help alleviate this kind of stress.
My dad was diagnosed in, yeah, so he jumped all over all those hurdles and, you know, had all the stress. And then at the end of that, he was kind of given a number of options, and it was very much sort of in his, pardon the pun, in his lap, yeah, to choose, yeah, himself. And, yeah, and that in itself was incredibly, you know, stressful.
Yeah. Trying to decide what, you know, it's just the responsibility of what happens if I make the wrong decision. And obviously your urologist will guide you as to your sort of a more recommended treatment. Some people with a low Gleason grade or low risk prostate cancer will still choose to have their prostate removed because they can't bear the idea of just leaving a cancer sort of in situ, which is, you know, understandable. And other patients, even when we sort of maybe recommend they have more radical treatment, would rather not, because they don't want all the side effects of the surgery. And I think that's why the PER test is so useful, because it can give you, even before you've done a biopsy, it can give you an idea of how aggressive and how likely to progress the disease is just from a urine sample. So again, it's another level you can counsel the patient. You can say, look, your chances of progressing based on your urine test result are X, Y, and Z. And then that gives them another layer of information, if you like.
And as Kate was saying, some men find the idea of having any kind of cancer in their body so distressing that they just want it removed, whether it's life-threatening or not. Professor Cooper says the men who are put on what's known as active surveillance actually have the most to benefit from the PER test.
You're diagnosed with prostate cancer. The clinician says, I really don't know what's going to happen. Let's put you on active surveillance. So you'll be monitored. You'll have PSA taken regularly. You may have a biopsy again at a later date. Now, what we find is if you take those men and then you give them a PER test, then it can really help predict whether you should really be staying on active surveillance or whether you should be going and having the treatment. And we found it's really, the predictive value is really remarkable. We found that in one study. We're trying to confirm that in a second study, because everything for clinical reliability, you'd have to repeat things 2 or 3 times and just show that it's correct again and again.
As I recall from my dad's diagnosis, it was lengthy, unpredictable, uncomfortable, and stressful. Presumably these tests cut out every single one of those.
The tests will help the patient and the clinician to be more certain about the course that the cancer is likely to take. So it can remove stress if it shows that you really have an indolent cancer and you weren't sure, then it can help remove stress in that sense. On the other hand, you may be wondering whether to have treatment because it might be aggressive, and the test will help you come to that decision because it will show you that this is another indicator that you really have an aggressive cancer and you need to be treated. So it can help both ways.
This could be, I mean, we've just talked about how it would be incorporated potentially in the British health system, but I'm assuming that internationally there are very similar diagnostic procedures and this could work equally well.
Considering the pure urine test and the Tiger tissue test that we've developed, we need to consider how they will progress into clinical use and how they will compare to other tests that are on the market. And this is an essential part of the activity of developing a diagnostic laboratory. We have to put together a business plan, that's what it's called. And so if you look at other tests that are available, particularly the tissue tests, they tend to be very expensive, and also urine tests. So they can cost between £500 and £3,000 to £5,000 just for a single test. Now, our view is that tests such as those are never really going to get a universal use just because of their cost, and people seem to be more interested in profit than patient benefit. And so one of the prime drivers of introducing these tests is that they should be relatively cheap. And we think that through that, they will be used much more widely than current tests that are available. This is particularly true for the pure tests that we would hope would cost no more than £100 or slightly more for a test, which is comparable to genetic tests that you'd have if you wanted to find out about your ancestors or relations or your ancestry. And that's why we're running the diagnostic laboratory ourselves at the moment. It's why we're fundraising for it, because we don't want to go into the commercial arena at this time, because we'd be looking for venture capital funding, which we could get 10 times over. There's absolutely no doubt about that. That's not the way we want to go. We feel that by keeping control of this, we can control its transition into a clinical test and use in the clinic and keep costs down. If we do make some small profit, then our intention would be to plough that back into further research that would develop the tests further. But that's not our prime aim. Our prime aim is to get this into wider use as possible for as many men as possible in as many countries as possible, as quickly as possible. And that's why we need funding to do this.
So any money that goes towards funding your tests now will fundamentally help save money internationally?
Yeah, any money that goes into our laboratory now will help speed up the process. We're using a model for this which will benefit the greatest number of men as quickly as we can. And that doesn't involve going through the normal commercial routes at this stage. We need to fundraise to draw money into this to allow us to carry out further clinical trials and also allow us to further refine the test.
So we're talking here today in 2021, you're in Norfolk, but this could reach men in India, China, the US, potentially by 2023, if all goes to plan.
I think if all goes to plan, we would hope to have this test widely available within 3 years globally. We have partners in Europe, we have partners in the US, we have partners in Australia, and they will all help us to assess the use of this test, how exactly it should be used, and also help in progressing the test into wider clinical use.
And wider clinical use, of course, ultimately means a better informed medic and a better informed patient. Trevor Beckford eventually opted for surgery.
Instead of taking the usual 2 to 3 hours, my operation took bloody ages, absolutely ages, because my prostate, the bit they cut out, weighed 90 grams and the normal is 20 grams. So on that basis, it was 4.5 times normal size. I now know that I was upside down on a table for those. I was actually under anaesthetic for 9 hours, I think.
And life after surgery has taken some getting used to. He's had some really useful advice from his urology nurse, Phil. But sex is not the same as it was before.
As a result of the size of the prostate, when it was cut out, all of the nerves were cut out as well. So, because I know they try to keep as many as possible, but my nervous system around the prostate was completely cut out and destroyed. So that does have an effect and makes it more difficult to get an erection. It's just small things. And I did know this, but you know, your erection is about an inch smaller than it used to be because they've cut an inch of your urethra and all the rest of it out.
But it's not impossible. You can have an erection. It's not a complete, you know, there is enough of an erection.
You can have an erection, but as Phil explained, it's an exercise. When you are a normal, healthy male, when you sleep, you get several erections throughout the night, and it's in effect exercise, you know, and that's how he described it. And once you lose this, of course, what you do is you lose the ability to get an erection naturally, subconsciously, and therefore you have to work at it. But yes, you still can get an erection. It's rather softer than before. And in order to have sexual intercourse with my wife, it's something that needs to be chemically enhanced, shall we say.
But that's doable.
It's doable. We can have sex, but you have to plan it a little bit more. It's funny, actually. Whereas in the old days, you know, my wife would have to take a pill so we could have sex. Now I've got to take the pill, you know. But
that's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting that you see it as a kind of evolution of your sexual lives together.
Yes, it is. And yes, it needs more planning now. And we, you know, we do different things.
So even though it's a dry orgasm, it's still an enjoyable orgasm. You still get the same feelings?
Yes, absolutely the same as before. Absolutely the same. That's not diminished.
Well, that's really good news. And I'm sure so many people will be really, really gratified to hear that, because I'm sure there's not many people feel able or inclined or articulate enough to explain it in the way that you have, which you've done beautifully. And I really appreciate that. I wonder about the other side of things then, the whole incontinence and control when you're doing your hobbies or riding a motorbike or whatever it is that you like to do. Has that been a problem?
That is more of a problem, yes. When I'm walking, for example, I love walking. We go for a walk, you know, nice 8 mile, 10 mile walk with my wife and wherever. We love that. When you're walking, it's much more difficult to control your pelvic floor. And therefore, you're more likely to go for a pee. And it's treated as a joke now amongst our family that, oh, Dad's off again because I'd have to go off into the bushes and have a pee. And, you know, that's fine. Now, occasionally that gets to be really quite panicky, because once you get it psychologically, once you get it in your brain that you need a pee, you need a pee, and you've got to deliver pretty quickly. Otherwise, it's all over the place and it could be quite difficult. And the other day, you know, I did have an accident. I did leak into my trousers. Fortunately, I was wearing dark trousers because there was no way I could change them. So that is an issue. That is an issue. And that is a constant thing. And, you know, once I was on the motorbike, and I've got waterproof leathers on the when I'm riding the motorbike. And, you know, I'm busting and trying to get all the layers off in order to pee. And you're really not worried about whether anybody can watch you or anything like that. You don't care. You just got to get rid of it, because otherwise you're going to fill up your trousers with, you know, oh, and it's that is an issue. that is an issue. And I, that's that, if you like, is the one, the biggest issue.
There can't be many people able to speak as openly and expressively about such a personal issue. But Trevor Beckford speaks for hundreds of thousands of men.
I'm sure that the others have given you facts and figures on prostate cancer. I believe in the UK it's one person every 45 minutes dies of prostate cancer. That's quite upsetting, you know. So getting involved in a project like this, it's hard to put it into words, really. It's rewarding. You sort of get up on a Monday and think, yeah, it's Monday, it's another week, I'm looking forward to this. You know, this is probably the first time in my working life that I genuinely enjoy going to work every single day. There's nothing about it I dislike.
That's really quite the recommendation there.
Last but not least, meet Paul Jackson. The job he loves so much is as quality assurance manager. He's the person helping the team set up the diagnostics lab so it can get accreditation from a government body called UCAS, that's UKAS. This is necessary to show that all practices are consistent and compliant.
UCAS, I've worked closely with them for several years now, and they go all over the world accrediting laboratories who want to have the UCAS British standard applied to their laboratory.
Right, so it's not just that other countries might have a similar system, it's that other countries are interested in incorporating the UCAS system.
Yes, so it's such well respected globally that, yeah, people are prepared to get people from the UK to go out and make sure that they are working to those standards.
So it's a shortcut to being assured of quality, like a Michelin star.
A Michelin star is an excellent comparison, really.
What was your first day on the job like? I guess you had to explain all this to all your colleagues.
Yeah. So there's several things you have to do, obviously. So I was like, right, I'm going to start at the beginning. I'm going to have a look at what we've got set up already. I'm going to have to shake a few trees here because it's going to upset some people. It's going to mean they're going to have to work a different way. So what I did, I sat down, I thought, right, I'm going to run a gap analysis. So I need to find what we're missing and what I need to do sort of to fill in those gaps to bring the UCAS accreditation together. The gap was huge, which was absolutely fantastic and quite a relief, to be honest, because there wasn't anything really set up. We've done the research. We haven't got a diagnostic lab. There was an empty space. It was just an empty room. So it was fantastic. So I could just walk in and say, this is what we need. This is how we need to set up this lab. We need to have it in different sections for different testing. I can write all of the procedures, the quality manual from scratch. It was quite a relief, to be honest.
So it wasn't a matter of telling the toddlers to tidy up their bedroom.
There was no bedroom to tidy. I've come in at the very beginning of the diagnostic lab setup. It means there's more work to do, but it's actually easier because I can implement how I want and the requirements of the UCAS standard from scratch. And it's perfect.
And what about explaining all those procedures to everyone on the team? And was that easy enough to do? I mean, can you give us one example of one sort of easy to visualise procedure that you had to get them to implement?
Yeah, sure. So, OK, we set up a diagnostic lab. We've got the equipment into the laboratory. A requirement of the UCAS standard is you need to monitor the temperature of those fridges and freezers. You are keeping DNA, RNA in it, which is very fragile, and they are stipulated that they have to be kept lower than minus 20 degrees. So all of a sudden you have to put in thermometers that have also been accredited by UCAS. You then have to monitor the freezers every single day.
The way I see it, again, with the children, is you are the dad or the mum saying, well, you need to make sure that you've done it this way. And have you thought about that? And, you know, you're sort of directing traffic to a certain extent.
Yeah, it can seem like that. It's quite easy for a quality assurance manager to seem bossy, needy, demanding. That's something that with experience you work out. You look at your team, you look at the people, and different people react to different things different ways. But in a child analogy that we was talking about, sometimes they'll need a cuddle. Sometimes they'll need to be told straight. And it's similar.
And Paul Jackson is in a hurry. Accreditation for the maths may take a while, but he hopes to have the lab ready to be assessed for accreditation by November 2021.
Wow. Now, you are a very amenable chap and very and nicely, softly spoken, but you're cracking the whip there, aren't you?
Yeah. I don't think anyone's ever told me that I cracked the whip. You have to be. Like I say, I have both of the standards with me here. I have a copy at home. I have a copy at work. It's a sad obsession that I have that sometimes you sit there and you think, I'm just going to look up about this or about that. So I'm very driven.
Which is probably why he fits in so well with the team. Professor Colin Cooper says from here on in, there's a final push to reach the fundraising goal of £3 million, which would enable the team to complete what he regards as phase three. The final phase of the research.
When we've succeeded in having the laboratory accredited, which we hope to achieve within the next 12 months, we need to carry out more clinical trials just to show people how the two tests, the pure test, the urine test, and also the Tiger, how well they work in a clinical setting. And this is quite an expensive process. So we're still trying to gather funds to do that. We've been very lucky because we've had many people who've generously donated their time and money to these projects. And without them, what we've done so far wouldn't have been possible. But there's still a way to go. But we hope to be there in about 2 years, I think. If we had the money, we could have a test that we could offer to patients within 2 years.
And that goes for both?
That's for both tests, yeah. I think the pure test will probably appear first because it's quite slightly easier to progress through the accreditation processes. The Tiger test, which is the test using all the maths, the accreditation of the maths is going to take, surprisingly, because you think maths might be quick, will take a little longer. So that will probably lag behind by about a year. So I would hope that within 2 years we'd have the pure test available and within 3 years we'd have the Tiger test available for use with patients. And then our job will be done, really.
It really sounds like it's very much about the team. It's really about the human resources, isn't it? Getting the right people in place.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. We've got a lot of excellent people who are linked to the laboratory. There are people who are the scientists. We've got many exceptional individuals looking after the laboratory, within the laboratory. And it's all these people together that are making this success. And it's been a real privilege to be a part of all of that.
And as we leave Professor Cooper to get back to his favourite place, the lab, I'd like to thank our donor and supporter community listening now, who've enabled the team to get this far. Without your support, none of the incredible advances and breakthroughs you've heard about would have been possible. Thank you. I hope you feel incredibly proud of what you've helped to achieve. Before we finish, let's hear for a final time from Trevor Beckford. As what I've learned through my conversations with Colin, Dan, Jeremy, Kate, and Paul, is that it's not really about latent process decomposition, microvesicles, or even licorice all sorts, but it's about dads and brothers, uncles and sons.
I mean, I mentioned my dad earlier, didn't I? He's 80. And yeah, so, I mean, we'd be on a Zoom call, you know, a lot of us, and all of a sudden, oh, I've got to go, you know. And he moves fast for an 80-year-old when he needs to.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, it can be really, really difficult if you, I mean, last week we've just been camping. And, you know, if you're going into the toilet and you need to go and there's no space available, it's dreadful. It really is. And it makes you feel like, you know, I'm sorry, I've just had an operation. Can I go to the front of the queue? Get out of it, you know, because otherwise, and there's nothing you could do.
But it hasn't stopped you getting on the bike. It hasn't stopped you going camping.
No, it doesn't stop me, and I won't let it stop me, because I will not be beaten by it. You know, until I die, I suppose, you know, that's the only way it's going to beat me in that sense. I suppose just to balance that, I should say that, you know, my PSA tests that since then have shown that I'm clear. So, you know, I mean, I'm not afraid that, you know, the cancer's running around my body at the moment and I'm going to die anytime soon. You know, to all intents and purposes, it is as successful as it could be. So that's good.
That's really good news. Very good.
That's it from this edition of the University of East Anglia Pioneer podcast. But you can help the story continue with a gift to support this vital work. The progress made so far is all down to the extraordinary generosity of a number of charities and UEA's philanthropic community, who've already given a staggering £1.5 million. But with £1.5 million still to raise to reach the £3 million needed, a donation from you now could help UEA ensure doctors and men around the world can start using these new prostate cancer tests as soon as possible. Please, will you give today and help make that moment arrive even sooner? To donate now, visit our website at www.uea.ac.uk/difference or email giving@uea.ac.uk to arrange a callback from the Development Office. But for now, from all the team here at UEA, thanks so much for listening and goodbye.